Thank you very much, Greg, and good morning to all of you. I'm very delighted to be with you. I note that both the building in Duluth, Minnesota, and the one in Staten Island are very similar to the architecture of this one. I feel right at home. And I guess it's not accidental since they were constructed about the same time, the 1890s. And I'm very delighted and honored to be with you. I also am very grateful and touched that the jazz musicians before us are joining me in this service. I want to offer my personal thanks to Dave Graham and to Greg Buford and Hassan Shakar. It is a delight that they will be collaborating and the balance of the service, as we have been inspired already by them. But it is especially appropriate given the celebration of the poet Langston Hughes, because Langston Hughes would visit jazz nightclubs to compose his poetry frequently. And at a deeper level, he wanted to convey in words the same spirit, the same pulsing life that was evident in jazz music. So my thanks to you in assisting with me. It also is appropriate that we celebrate Langston Hughes because not only is Black History Month designated for February, but February 1st would be Langston Hughes' birthday. He would be 110 years old this Saturday. I've always taken to a line of the Unitarian minister. This was before the merger, so he was just Unitarian. John Haynes Holmes in Manhattan, when he said that when he uses the word God, he means poetry. Books of theology gather dust on his library shelves, but the words of poets, he said, are stained with my fingers and blotted by my tears. John Haynes Holmes, by the way, got in trouble both in the country and in the denomination for opposing America's involvement in World War I, a horrible experience in terms of death toll and suffering. The first time I personally heard of Langston Hughes, who has been called the Black Poet Laureate of the 20th century in this country, was in my 8th grade class. His poem Mother to Son was in our American literature textbook, the only item in that book, I believe, composed by an African American. And that was one more African American than was in my 8th grade class. Concord and Walnut Creek, California, suburbs of San Francisco, where I grew up, were de facto racially segregated, as so much of America was at that time. And my parents, who believed in desegregation, nonetheless, were in a neighborhood where there was precious little, although the only community that was agreeable to desegregating at all. I didn't read or think about Langston Hughes for a number of years, but I have discovered in recent years a wonderful two-volume biography of him by Arnold Rampersall. It reads like a novel. Appropriately enough, it's called The Life of Langston Hughes. Not only did Langston Hughes have an uncommon poetic gift, recognized in his own predominantly white 8th grade class,
who voted him the poet of the class.
He was also a seer.
What do I mean by that?
Not in the sense of seeing into the future, but seeing deeply into the present. He could capture a reality or a visual experience with pulsing vividness. Listen to how he described in his diary a twilight scene on his trip to Mexico. "It is sunset," he wrote, "and Mexico's great jagged mountains are bathed in yellow wine and honey. There are some old peaks in the background that have wrapped a purple veil upon themselves and sit huddled like Indians." He was a teenager when he wrote those lines. Langston Hughes was born in Joplin, Missouri. His grandfather was Lewis Leary, one of those killed in John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry, immortalized in another poem. His other grandfather, his namesake, Charles Langston, participated in forcibly preventing a fugitive slave from being returned to the South in 1858. And his great-uncle, John Langston, was the first black American to hold office in this country as a result of a popular vote, becoming a congressperson from Virginia. For all of the pride and heroic accomplishment that Langston Hughes' grandmother, in particular, tried to instill in young Langston, he didn't feel any overwhelming warmth either from her or from his mother or father. His father was an irritable man, a person given to denigrating black Americans, even though he was one himself. Left fairly early in Langston's childhood to build a career in Mexico, and that was the reason that Langston traveled there as a teenager. There was one great pleasure Langston savored as a child, and that was the public library, especially the big one in Topeka, Kansas. He learned to read and enjoy reading voraciously. He read Huckleberry Finn, Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois. Then one afternoon, while he was sitting in the library, he heard some boys playing outside, and he suddenly felt guilty that he was inside and lonely, being so bookish. I could identify with that. I preferred to stay inside when I was 9, 10 years old, trying to read Shakespeare, thinking that I should be outside playing street football or capturing tadpoles, which were available nearby my house. Actually, Langston Hughes did become quite athletic, excelled in track in high school, but he never lost his infatuation with reading, and he identified very closely with Walt Whitman, whom he felt was a true poet for the common man and common woman. Something else that I found quite distinctive about Langston Hughes, I identified with him religiously. We think of the African American population as predominantly associated with the Christian church, with the Black Baptist church. And his parents, especially his aunt, particularly, were devoutly Christian. His aunt took him to a Christian revival when Langston Hughes was about 12 years old. And at this religious event, as you may know, people are asked to testify to their own faith in Jesus and announce that Jesus had entered their personal lives. Everyone had done so, young and old, by the time it got to be Langston Hughes' turn, and all eyes were on him. And he finally admitted that that was his belief. And everyone cheered. But he cried all night. His aunt thought that this was just a normal response to this great transformation, but in fact he was crying because he did not have that experience of this particular idea of Jesus, quote, entering his life. He was crying because he had misrepresented himself. He would never have an evangelistic or orthodox Christian outlook. Yet he felt he conveyed his passion for life in a spiritual way. He was the polar opposite of his father. He had great pride in the dignity and the beauty of African Americans. And he wrote a poem that early on expressed this lifelong commitment. The poem he wrote on the back of an envelope is "The Negro Speaks of Rivers." Think about rivers. That's where civilization started. The Tigris, Euphrates, the Indus, the Nile. Rivers meant a lot to him in American history, too. The Great Mississippi and how it was associated with Huck Finn's attempt to bring Jim to freedom. And so I begin with poetry and jazz with Langston Hughes, "The Negro Speaks of Rivers." I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans. And I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. While Langston Hughes commanded the respect and developed friendships among various white classmates and others throughout his life, he not surprisingly ran into racial prejudice constantly. At the age of 7, he was not allowed to swim at the local YMCA or join the Boy Scouts. He loved movies and was a fan, especially of Charlie Chaplin. But one day, the woman at the box office told Langston, "Your people can't come in anymore," and pointed to a sign, "No colored admitted." A school teacher once took away licorice from a child, saying, "You don't want to eat these. You'll be black like Langston." When he was older, bigotry continued to dog him, as you might expect. He walked into the wrong neighborhood in Chicago.
and took a broken jaw home as a souvenir. He did not have the sort of temperament, though, that would lead him to a burst of temper. But he also didn't capitulate when treated unjustly. One of the more unpleasant experiences as a young adult that he faced was at a museum cafeteria over in New York City. The woman at the cash register was furious by the look in her eyes to see Langston Hughes standing and waiting to pay for his lunch, kept punching the keys until his lunch cost was an astounding sum of money. He answered, "That's not the right price." She flew into more of a rage. He never paid the price she asked him, but he also did not become enraged himself. The same kind of incident at Columbia University, where he was admitted. The housing official told him he did not have a room. Langston Hughes, who had traveled from Mexico to get there, pulled a moldering piece of paper out of his pocket that confirmed his room while he was attending Columbia. He was the only one of 12 black students at Columbia that year to be admitted to the dormitories. Langston Hughes arrived at Columbia University in 1921, and he didn't like it, but he did love Harlem and was part of the so-called Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. But he did a lot of things in a lot of places. He worked for a Greek farmer in Staten Island. He worked on a ship that went along the coast of Africa. He overcame adversity. And this next poem, Mother to Son, talks about that journey. Well, son, I'll tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it, and splinters, and boards torn up, and places with no carpet on the floor. Bare. But all the time, I've been climbing on and reaching landings, turning corners, sometimes going in the dark. There ain't been no light. So don't you turn back. Don't you sit down on the steps, because you find it's kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I'm still going, honey. I'm still climbing. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. Mention that Langston Hughes was part of this great efflorescence that occurred in Harlem in the 1920s, the Harlem Renaissance. And it's appropriate that so much of the music that Dave and the ensemble are playing are of Duke Ellington, because Langston Hughes, so much like Duke Ellington, he wanted his doorbell chime to play Ellington. He was part of a group that included Bill Bojangles Robinson, Fletcher Henderson and her orchestra, Walter White. But another person he especially loved was the singer Billie Holiday. He wrote this poem called Song for Billie Holiday. What can purge my heart of the song and the sadness? What can purge my heart but the song of the sadness? Do not speak of sorrow with dust in her hair, or bits of dust in eyes, a chance that wind blows there. The sorrow that I speak of is dusted with despair. Voice of muted trumpet, cold breaths and warm air, bitter television blurred by sound that shimmers. Where? One of his favorite songs is God Bless the Child.
Langston Hughes never married, and never, to even his biographer's knowledge, had a lover. There was speculation that he was gay. We don't know. He kept his sexual life very private. He wrote over 40 books of poetry, but also novels, plays, short stories, some of them humorous. He was, at one time, after his trip to the Soviet Union, called before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, led by a certain Senator Joseph McCarthy. In 1956, he read about Rosa Parks being unwilling to relinquish her seat on the bus. Let me correct that to say December 1955. And he followed with avid interest and fervent support the civil rights movement and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., although he himself was more a literary figure, less a leader of social action efforts. There was no question about his deep-seated sympathy for equality and justice for the races. The last two prose poems that I will share today to music show two important sides of the character and sensibility of Langston Hughes. The first is his answer to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. And it's arguably Hughes' most famous poem, titled Harlem. The second poem was his quest to be a voice of plain human beings, black as well as white. His answer to Walt Whitman's I Hear America Singing. It's called I Too. First Harlem. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? or fester like a sore, and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crusted sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?
That's all I can do to keep from dancing. I actually feel like I've been dancing the whole hour. Last poem, I too am America, is answer to Walt Whitman. I hear America singing. I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They sent me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am. Because I, too, am American. You please join me in hymn number 348, Guide My Feet.
And hues that are in our hymnal. Hold fast to dreams, for if dreams die, life is but a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field frozen with snow. Hold fast to dreams.